Right, now I'm delighted to be joined once more by Lord Peter of Ingatestone Hall. And last time you were here, Lord Peter, back in November, I think we were looking at the incredible career of Sir William Peter, who, amongst other things, served as Secretary of State for no less than four Tudor monarchs, Henry VIII, Edward VI, and both Queens Mary I and Elizabeth I. And today we're going to be turning our attention to the 7th, 8th, and 9th Lord Peters. First off, it has to be said that both the 7th and 8th Lord Peters were cut short in their primes, weren't they?
Well, yes, they were. Premature death, I fear. Smallpox then was a real scourge, an incurable disease. I have to say that the 7th Lord Peter's wife was even more unfortunate in that she was left an orphan. Both her parents were dead by the time she was three, and then she lost her two elder sisters and her brother before she was 15.
Oh, so goodness me.
It was not uncommon.
Well, apparently not. What years are we looking at here?
We're looking at the beginning of the 18th century. The seventh Baron was born in 1689,
yeah.
Stroke 90.
Right. Oh, I see. Right. Okay. Now, whilst the seventh and eighth Lord Peters had very short lives, for all that, they both made their mark, didn't they?
Well, I think the eighth more than the seventh. The seventh's only real claim to fame is that he was the model for the Baron in Alexander Pope's poem, The Rape of the Lock.
Really?
It was based on a true incident when the seventh Lord snipped a lock of hair from his cousin Arabella Fermor at a tea party, and this caused outrage in both families. And so Alexander Pope, who was a friend of the family, was asked to write a sort of humorous poem to sort of diffuse the situation. Unfortunately, he so mocked everyone involved that it made things rather worse. But the poem was, of course, as we know, a fantastic success.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what happened after that? You say it all caused a bit of a furore.
Yes, it was no more than a flirtatious gesture. There was nothing going on between them. There was recently a novel came out alleging that there was a sort of great romance there, but it wasn't so. Because in fact, he was married shortly afterwards. He was married to a Lancastrian heiress called Catherine Walmsley.
But he certainly got very, very heavily involved in botany and horticulture, did he not?
That was the son, the eighth, yes.
Oh, was it? Right,
yes.
Right. I thought the seventh had done that as well.
No, I don't think so. Not that know of.
Right.
And as I say, he was dead by the time he was 23 anyway, so he didn't have much chance.
No, he didn't, did he?
But his son, from an early age, had a great interest in botany, and at Thorndon Hall, indulged this to an enormous extent, having great greenhouses full of tropical plants and enormous works in the park, transplanting fully grown elms, which would be... we don't have any elms anymore.
No. But well, I remember the Dutch elm disease.
Quite a demanding job today, even with all the plant we've got. How they did it in those days, who knows, but he did it. But more to the point, he also imported enormous numbers of quite new species from the New World. He was in partnership with a seed collector out there. So
we
had Virginia maple and a whole list, which I haven't got in front of me.
He didn't live until he was past, what, 29?
Well, that's right.
So,
yes,
you know, he
that's possibly
of,
why he isn't better known than he is, because, as I say, he was very highly regarded, but after his death, all his works were sort of dissipated, if you like. There was no one else. He had an infant son, but there was no one else to sort of carry on his works, and so certainly the greenhouses fell into rack and ruin.
But by the time he was 16, he was looking after the management of his grandmother's gardens at Thorndon,
right.
wasn't
yes,
he?
It's
unbelievable.
His interest in the subject stemmed from a very early age, yes.
Yes. So he also, unfortunately, his death brought everything to a rather abrupt end. And then the ninth Baron Peter, Robert Edward, he was just 3 months old when his father died.
That's right, that's right. And so the estate went into the hands of trustees, who I'm sure did their best. But of course, trustees tend to be rather unimaginative in their approach. They have to play safe all the time.
That's right.
And so essentially the whole place fell into disrepair. There, at one moment there was a serious fire. This was the old house. This was the house sort of in the valley towards very near where the A127 is now.
Right.
Much further to the south of the new house. And so he decided to pull that house down and built an entirely new one, the one we see today, on the brow of the hill.
So how did he set about restoring Thorndon Hall then, did he?
Well, he rebuilt it entirely scratch. It was... I can't help feeling slightly folly de grandeur. we no longer own it because it was largely destroyed by fire at the end of the 19th century. We never had the means to rebuild it. And I think by and large that's quite a blessing, really, because what a burden that would have been. It was quite a burden in those days. It would have been intolerable now.
I'd imagine it would be. Now, he's also renowned for his efforts to sweep away the restrictive laws affecting Roman Catholics, was he not?
Yes, and the thing was, by that time, certainly, the sort of reason that Catholics were ostracised from society to some extent hadn't really very little to do with dogma or belief. It was entirely a political matter.
Yes, yeah.
And he set out to try and persuade the government that Catholics, although they would be guided by the Pope in spiritual matters, in temporal matters, they were as loyal Englishmen as the next fellow. The clergy were never going to do that, and so it was up to him and a lay committee to work towards that. And it did have a measure of success in that the first sort of mitigation of the anti-Catholic laws happened in 1789, I think, was the first act. It was a small thing, but it was the first move in the right direction.
So how did he set about this to achieve his goal?
Well, really, by persuading the government, as I say, that Catholics were able to draw a line between spiritual matters and temporal matters, and therefore they weren't going to conspire with the French and Spanish to stage a coup dethroning the Protestant monarch.
Well, in fact, that must have been quite successful because George III, I think, he chose to stay at Thorndon, did he not?
That was, yes, a very strong sign of the success he's making. George, Worley was a place where they used to have manoeuvres at regular times. The militia would stage battles there, and George III came down to watch one of these and agreed to stay the night at Thorndon Hall after that. And
so that must have been quite a feather in his cap.
Yes, a feather, certainly a feather in his cap. Not completely... how shall I say, welcome, in that it had all been fixed up. The king was going to arrive on a certain day. And so there was a fury of preparation of, you know, repainting the whole house, and guilders were brought in and everything. But also, of course, the food for the king and his considerable train. At the last moment, the visit was delayed. It was going to now happen a fortnight later than originally planned.
That must have really caused havoc.
There was all this food that And so Lord Peter says in his diary that he had to hold these dinner parties for neighbours in order to eat up all this food.
Must have cost a fortune.
Very good things, he says.
Must have cost a bomb.
It did cost quite a lot, yes.
But it was the first time, was it not, that a monarch had visited a Roman Catholic household since the Reformation?
That's right, right, yes.
Now, later,
so it was a significant gesture, you know.
Now, later on, I think he became chairman of the Chelmer and Blackwater Navigation as well.
He did, he was the first chairman. To what extent he actually, that was any more than a titular post, he wasn't much of a civil engineer, I don't think. And so, but yes, he did. He was the chairman of the first board that oversaw the construction of the.
That's canal. Right, and they built a canal connecting Chelmsford to the sea near Maldon.
Yes.
Was that not right? And this was at a time when we were at war with France, and he raised a company of volunteers.
That's right. The Ingatestone and the Brentwood and Ingatestone Volunteers, which were just a sort of militia that he raised. It was planned that his son would be command this body, but that was forbidden, of course, because Catholics couldn't be military officers.
Couldn't be trusted. Now, I believe that I'm right in saying that the banners for these volunteers are still hanging in Ingatestone. Well, they were still hanging in Ingatestone Church in 1848. I don't know where they are now.
Yes, I didn't know that, I must say. No, as far as I know, they have disappeared.
Yes, yeah.
Be interesting to see that.
Now, he married twice, didn't he?
He did. Interestingly, both his wives were from the very large Howard family.
Yes.
But interestingly, his second wife, now listen to this carefully, his second wife was the younger sister of his son's wife. Now, does that make him his own brother-in-law?
I don't think I can work that one out. That's quite incredible. Now, it's been suggested, I think, that Robert's death really marked the end of an era for the Peter family. Would you say that was so?
We always sort of regarded as the sort of apogee of our fortunes.
Watershed.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, possibly the burden of Thornhill Hall as much as anything
yes.
else. But also, times were changing.
Yeah.
Up to then, particularly being a Catholic family, the local Catholic gentry were very much the protectors of the local Catholic population, and there was a very sort of almost feudal relationship there. But that was all changing, A, with Catholic emancipation, but also with the enormous number of Irish Catholics coming into the country. The whole balance of things were changing.
So. Was it not also the whole country was changing because the Industrial Revolution was coming along?
And
there was an emergence of the enfranchised middle class, which signalled the end, I believe, of the comfortable paternalism of the squirearchy.
Well, that's a good a way of putting it as any.
But his funeral was still a pretty grand affair, was it not?
It was. I mean, you read some accounts and they say that he was going to be borne from Thornden Hall to be interred at the church at Ingatestone.
Yeah.
And so this vast procession formed up. Some accounts say that by the time the head of the procession arrived at Ingatestone Church, the rear of the procession had not yet left Thornden. Now, I think that's a slight exaggeration, but it was a very... I do have a list here of what it... if I can find it, of what it consisted of. Yes, two companies, three divisions of the Ingatestone Brentwood Volunteers, who I've already referred to, two companies of pioneers, two artillery field pieces, the band of the Royal Bucks Regiment, 30 mutes and cloakmen, Robert's tenants, 2x2, the post chaise and 2 carriages from the Thornden Stables, 7 mourning coaches, each drawn by 6 horses, carrying members of the family, clergy and household, and a host of outriders, grooms and other mourners.
Don't me. Well, I imagine there was a wake afterwards.
And in the background, I may say, two artillery field pieces firing a salute all along the way.
Must have made a lot of noise. And afterwards, I would imagine they would all have to have repaired back for the wake, which would have been quite spectacular.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, look, Peter, thank you very much indeed for that outline. Now, we very much hope that you'll come back again, and particularly apart from telling us more about some of your very colourful family, perhaps with the summer season coming in and with people wanting to visit Ingate Stone Hall, you could give us a bit of a background on Ingate Stone Hall at some
point.
I'd
be very happy to do that.
That would be wonderful. Well, we should look forward to seeing you again before too long.